This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Yesterday, the music world lost a true innovator.
It's the Les Paul Show.
Hi. Hello, folks. Let's see, I've got my guitar, I got my wife, Mary.
Hi.
And I got a room just loaded with electronics. We've got some inventions here that make one voice sound like many voices and one guitar like many guitars. And by means of these 6L6s and plugging them into this amplifier, why, we managed to...
Well, why don't you grab a guitar and show the people what you can do?
All right, I got a lot of ideas. Here we go. Now, that's one guitar. Now, if you want two, I just throw a switch.
How about three?
Easy. Now, if you want four, switch.
How about five?
It's a cinch. Now, if you want six, here's a half a dozen easy ones.
Guitarist and inventor Les Paul died yesterday in White Plains, New York. He was 94. Les Paul has been called the Thomas Edison of music. He spent his life playing guitar, inventing guitars to play, and inventing devices to record himself on. He invented the solid-body electric guitar, overdubbing, reverb, and multi-tracking, innovations that helped make rock and roll and modern recording possible. But Paul himself stuck mostly to jazz and middle-of-the-road pop. In the 1950s, he had several hits with his wife Mary Ford, such as How High the Moon, Vaya con Dios, and Bye Bye Blues. Les Paul began experimenting with guitar amplification in the 30s. He shattered his right elbow in a car accident in 1948. Once said it would be immovable, so he had it permanently set at an angle that would allow him to keep playing guitar. He was still performing as recently as this June. Terry Gross spoke with Les Paul in 1992 when he was 76 years old. They started with his 1948 recording of Lover, recorded in his garage, which he said was the first recording to combine all his inventions and recording techniques into one bag of tricks.
Les Paul, welcome to Fresh Air. So is that you playing all the parts?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Was this the first record that you overdubbed on?
Oh, no. No, I started it in 1933. I started in the 20s by punching holes in my mother's piano rolls. But I did it because the rhythm guitar player and bass player would go home and I'd say, darn it, I wanted to have him play Limehouse Blues, and I wanted to try something. And I'd say, well, as long as they're not here, what I'll do is I'll play the bass and I'll play the guitar and I'll do that. But I never recognized that that could be such a tremendous tool.
What was different on this recording of Lover from anything that you'd ever done before?
Well, the sped-up sound, the echo, the playing the bass line, making a guitar sound like a bass. This is the first time in history that anybody had ever done anything like that. And then to speed the guitar up and slow the guitar down, and you get all these different sounds, but muffling your strings with your wrist, and these were all new things to be exposed to the world. And of course, I had my problems because so many people weren't ready to accept it.
So on Lover, the high, fast, trebly sounds that we hear, that's a sped-up guitar?
Mm-hmm. Along with the normal guitar, mm-hmm. The whole idea there is to be able to get octaves and to go an octave below and an octave above and to do all the harmony parts and everything, you know. And that was not the very first record I ever made that way, but like I say, it was the first. That was the first one to come out, and that came out about a week after I had an automobile accident, where for 2 years I was to be in the hospital, just in a basket. everything I had was broken, and I was in bad shape for about 2 years. So I had a lot of time to think, and I unfortunately didn't have that many records in the can, so to speak. What I had are records that were completely done except for the last part, which was the melody. And the reason I left that melody off is I figured that every week that went by, I got better. And if I got better, why, I had newer ideas. And so I'd leave that last part off. And after the automobile accident, I had to do the next recordings in a cast, a body cast. And so with one arm fixed, right up even with my face in air, the only thing I could move with my right hand was my thumb. So I put a thumb pick on that, laid the guitar. And I had a rack built to hold the guitar horizontal, and it laid there flat. And I just stood up and played my part. And that's how I made the parts for the next four or five records.
This might be the dictionary definition of obsessive.
Boy, I'm telling you, you learn in a hurry to live with the obstacles, and they can be overcome.
Now, let me get to one of the hits that you had. Let's talk about How High the Moon, which you recorded with Mary Ford, one of your big hits.
Thank you.
Let's hear some of it. Record Mary's voice to get that echo?
Well, that was something that I spent 2 years trying to find out. I didn't want reverb like an empty room. I didn't want Carnegie Hall. I didn't want that sound. I said to my friend, very dear friend, he and his girlfriend, Mary was my girlfriend, and myself, and a fellow named Wally Jones, that we were all sitting in a little tavern at Santa Monica and Western out in Hollywood, and Lloyd was arm wrestling with me, and we had a pitcher of beer and some popcorn, and we're watching the fights on Friday night, and he pulled my arm down real easy, and he says, "Les, you're not concentrating. You're usually pretty rough to bring that arm down on." And I said, "Well, I'm thinking of that echo." And I said, "I haven't figured that delay out yet. I haven't figured it out." And he says, "Well, you still worried about that thing?" And I says, "Yeah, I need it, and I don't know how to get it." And he says, "Well, explain it to me again." And so this night, Lloyd, I explain it to Lloyd again. I says, "Picture that you're on the Alps." I say, "Hello, hello, hello, hello." And I said, "I want it to repeat, and I want it to repeat, and I want the delay and the decay, I want to be able to vary it." And lo and behold, he says to me, "You mean like putting the playback head behind the record head?" Oh, boy, I threw $10 down on the table, and I said to Wally, "Pay the bill and bring the girls," you know. And we left him with the $10 bill and the girls and the beer and the popcorn and the TV. We're gone. And by the time they got home, you could hear all over the neighborhood, hello, 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 you know? And we'd found the echo, the delay.
You know what I want to know? Why did you want to have echo on her voice?
That's interesting, because I felt as though when you play the note dry, just dead, it just drops like a rock. And it ends right there. And a lot of times you'd like to have that note hang on after you've left it and go to the next note. And it's very similar to ambience in a room, the sound of a room, where it's enhanced by bare walls. If I happen to be talking to you and I happen to be in a very empty room, you could recognize that. Riding in your car, listening at home, you say, "Well, I can tell that these people are talking in a very empty room," or you can say they're talking in a phone booth. It's so small, or it's a very large hall. So you have command over what you wish to do. And in this case, I didn't want that note to say, hey, and just go on like Carnegie Hall. I wanted to go, hey, hey. See? And now, if you want, you put a little tail on it. You go, hey, 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 hey. You know? And it gives you such command of so many things, the toys to work with. Today, they're not. I call them toys because the kids, they have all these little boxes that you can go in and buy in the store. When I was a kid and I visualized this thing, the reason I had to invent it is because you couldn't buy it in a store. If I wanted it, I had to make one.
Les Paul speaking with Terry Gross in 1992. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 1992 interview with guitarist and inventor Les Paul. He died yesterday at the age of 94.
I saw you about a year ago at Fat Tuesdays, a club in New York where you play every Mondays. Mm-hmm. Every Monday, and you sounded terrific.
Thank you.
I understand that you have arthritis of the fingers. How do you play?
Well, after my heart surgery in 1980. They just says, well, you're going to have to do something else because you can't play, your hands are gone. And I only had a couple of fingers on each hand then. Now I have no fingers in the right hand move. They're fixed. And so there's no movement except at the knuckles. And in the left hand, I only have two fingers, really one and a half, because the first finger is half frozen and painful. What do I do? I just have figured out that if I could do that, whatever I did then, I just figure out how to do that with two fingers. And so what I have done is, I says, well, what I used to do with two hands and all my fingers, I'm sure it can be done. And lo and behold, it can be.
So you've really taken the same approach to your body as you've taken to designing instruments and engineering equipment.
Oh, are you? You're great. You're great. Terry, you're great. The key to that is that the same will, the same power that you have to destroy yourself, you can use to make yourself well. If you have arthritis, you just have to have a iron jaw, and you got to go in there and not use any cop out that, well, I can't play anymore because of the arthritis. You just say, there's a way. And I think that determination, I think that, and of course you have to have a lot of luck and you have to have the right genes and all that jazz to go with it. But I think the bottom line is that if you want to hard enough, you can do it.
What's your threshold for pain? How good are you with pain?
Oh, boy, I tolerate pain. It's unbelievable what you can tolerate if you have that, again, if you have that attitude about it. First of all, you got to think up and not down. And first of all, you don't think of work as a dirty word. You think of that as something that is a privilege. When I was in the hospital and the doctor called me in the office and he says, promise me you'll work hard. And I says, Doc, I thought that's what put me in here. And he says, no, Les. He says, nobody died of overwork. Promise me that you'll work hard. So I went upstairs, and they wheeled me upstairs, and I asked the nurse for a piece of paper, and I drew a line down the center of it, and I put plus on one side, minus on the other. This one, that one, all the great things that we've done in my lifetime. And when it came to the end, I looked at the list, and it was overwhelming that the best time I had in my life was playing in a little nightclub. Now, I'd given up the guitar in 1965 and says, let the young kids have it. I've made my money. I'm going to get out and invent and go manage and record and go another direction, but forget the guitar. This piece of paper in 1980 said to me I should go back and play the guitar, and where I was happiest is in a little club. An intimate nightclub. So when I got well, I marched into New York, and I looked at all the clubs, and finally I find this club. And I said, this is my club. So I go to the manager, and he's 6'4". He's a big, tall guy, Scott. And I said, sir, I'd like to talk to you. My name is Les Paul. He says, Les who? I says, Les Paul.
No.
Yeah. Les Paul. And he says, name sounds familiar. I says, yeah, I play the guitar, and I'd like to come in and play in your club. And he says, well, what do you do? What kind of music you play? And I says, you know, darn if I know. I says, I've never been able to put a handle on that one. And he says, well, what have you got? And I says, well, I got a trio, and I'd like to come in here. And he says, well, I don't think we're interested. And I says, not only that, I'd like to be in on a Monday night. He says, we're not even open on Mondays. And he says, no. And I says, but I'm willing to work for nothing. He says, we're interested.
Right.
And so the bottom line was is that I made a deal with the boss. And he says, I'll put you in for 2 weeks. And I'll take the door and part of the liquor and whatever. Went in there for 2 weeks, and the audience reaction was tremendous, and it was loaded, and you couldn't get in, and it was just great.
Are you still inventing, or are you still in the process of creating things?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
What are you working on?
We're working on a bass, Les Paul bass, that will be at the NAMM show next week. We're working on all kinds of things. I've invented a thing for piano. I got another thing for high blood pressure. I got all kinds of things.
Something for high blood pressure?
Mm-hmm.
Are you getting into the medical field now?
Well, it's just that...
You need it.
Not that I need it. I saw that that there was room for it in the medical world. There's a lot of things that you recognize if you're lying in bed and you see a guy do something that's the hard way. And you say, you know, how come you're doing it that way? Well, the same thing applies to... it goes all the way back to, Terry, if I can really take you way back, it's the first time that my mother in her home had a radio, a Victrola, okay, that's the gramophone, that's the phonograph, okay, and a player piano, and I'm sitting there with all these things. And I looked at it and I says, you know, there's something interesting here. This piano, I can punch a hole in it wherever I wish, and that note will come out. And I can slow it down and speed up, and it doesn't change pitch. Okay? It just gets slower or faster. If I put my hand on a phonograph record and I slow it down, the pitch changes. Why? And that's the key to the whole thing, that curiosity of that you just asked that question, why, and you got your life cut out for you.
Well, Les Paul, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Les Paul speaking with Terry Gross in 1992. He died yesterday at the age of 94. You can see a slideshow, listen to his music, and hear more remembrances at freshair.npr.org. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. This weekend marks the 40th anniversary of the Woodstock Festival, and there are plenty of commemorative books, concerts, recordings, and reissues. Rhino Records has released a 6-disc box set of live excerpts from the concert, and Sony Legacy has issued 5 deluxe double CDs, pairing what were then the current albums by Sly and the Family Stone, Janis Joplin, Johnny Winter, The Jefferson Airplane, and Santana with the full soundtrack of their Woodstock appearances. In a few minutes, we'll hear the recollections of 2 of the concert's original producers, recorded on the festival's 20th anniversary in 1989. But first, rock historian Ed Ward has these reflections on some of the music performed at the event.
To get back to the warning that I've received, you may take it with however many grains of salt you wish, that the brown acid that is circulating around us is not specifically too good. It's suggested that you do stay away from that. Of course, it's your own trip, so be my guest, but please be advised that there is a warning on that one, okay?
A friend of mine who was there, hearing that I was writing about the Woodstock anniversary, said, in no uncertain terms, there was no good music at Woodstock. After listening to most of the 6 discs of the Woodstock box, plus the entire sets of both the Jefferson Airplane and Sly and the Family Stone, I can't quite agree, but I do see what he meant. And I don't think we can blame the famous brown acid, the flat blue acid, the green acid, or any of the other drugs for it, not directly. Some of the problem was technical. The sound system was cobbled together from movie theater systems, which was the best they could do at the time. The bands couldn't hear themselves too well in the monitors, and there were lots of outages. Another part of the problem wasn't as simple, but as glaring today. A lot of the talent was substandard. In short, Woodstock substituted quantity for quality on the basis of what we can hear today. The entire first day was almost a total disaster. Richie Havens, called into service to open when the band scheduled to open, Sweetwater, had yet to show up, did a yeoman job, but then Sweetwater showed up and played an incoherent mishmash of flute and chick vocal-led junk. They were followed by the now-forgotten Tim Sumner, whose lightweight songs and voice are entirely unmemorable. Tim Hardin followed him, sounding asleep, or more likely stoned, and then Ravi Shankar came on and did a couple of showy numbers of the sort he knew hippies liked. He was followed by the worst act of the day, Melanie, whose grating, whining voice delivered, among others, a song called Beautiful People, with lyrics like, "You take care of me, maybe I'll take care of you." Thanks, Mel. The day ended finally with professional sets from Arlo Guthrie and Joan Baez. The next day really typified the festival, starting off with another forgotten band, Quill, going to a folky set by Country Joe McDonald, and then a band on its way up, Santana, whose Latin rock fusion led the way for the second generation of San Francisco bands. I've never liked them, but their passion is obvious. Next, John Sebastian provided more folky sweetness, and then came Keith Hartley, a British drummer with a blues band who's never allowed his set to be used on film or record. He was followed by the incredible String Band, British psychedelic folkies, whose best work was far behind them, after which came another harbinger of the 70s, Canned Heat, who not only provided 28 minutes of something called Woodstock Boogie, which I declined to experience, but who also, according to soundman Chip Monk, fried the amps. Mountain was next, with a proto-metal act complete with portentous lyrics, and then the Grateful Dead, one of the few bands at the height of their powers at the time they performed, with a set Deadheads don't really consider very good. The best was yet to come, although it was getting late. Creedence Clearwater Revival apparently didn't know there were 500,000 people there, and did their usual tight set to the darkness, and flew back out. After that came Janis Joplin, who was apparently channeling a chicken.
Never, 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 never why. Tell me if I want to ask you now. I said, tell me if I want to lean on. I said, if I want to put my arm around. I said, I want a little help sometimes. I need a little help sometimes. Baby, baby, baby.
This sort of histrionics, of course, was also going to be heard a lot in the decade ahead, although Joplin would be dead in a little over a year. Following her came one of the few really historic sets at Woodstock, as Sly and the Family Stone came on and delivered a dose of showbiz at 3 a.m. After them, The Who managed to play Tommy, yet another foretaste of the worst impulses of the 70s. Had I been there, I would have stuck around until the next morning to see one of my then-favorite bands, the Jefferson Airplane, and I would have been disappointed. The band, apparently heavily dosed on orange acid, battled the sound system and each other to a truce over nearly 2 hours, a set that left me tense listening to it 40 years later. Then I probably would have left, missing a surprisingly good set by Joe Cocker, 10 years after his legendary guitar excess, which has been withdrawn from the reissues, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, a terrible version of the Paul Butterfield Band, the execrable Sha-na-na's camped-up doo-wop, and finally Jimi Hendrix battling a new band he'd thrown together for the occasion and dumped almost immediately afterwards. Excess, histrionics, and pretension, those were the coming trends at Woodstock. Peace, love, and music, the supposed drawing cards, would soon seem quaint relics of a bygone era.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France. John Roberts and Joel Rosenman were two of the originators of the Woodstock Festival. They used money Roberts had from an inheritance and found themselves in an undertaking far bigger than they bargained for. They collaborated on a 1974 book called Young Men with Unlimited Capital. Terry spoke to them in 1989 on the 20th anniversary of the festival. They told her they never planned on hosting a crowd of 400,000.
Our first go-round, we hoped to get about 25,000 people. That was in, say, March of 1969. By mid-April, we realized we might actually attract 35,000 to 50,000. By, say, early June, we were looking at 75,000. By late July, we thought improbably enough that we were going to have 100,000. And by the day before the concert, we had everybody in America.
There's a lot of interesting behind-the-scenes stories in your book. One of them that interested me was this blackmail call that you got from a member of the New York Underground. And it turned out, I think, to be Abbie Hoffman?
It was Abbie Hoffman. Of course, we have a fairly unique and different perspective about Woodstock, having been, as it were, in the boiler room, constructing and running this particular operation. And most people don't know about that story, and it's in the book. But the Underground had hoped that, the Radical Underground, I should say, had hoped that Woodstock would be a forum for their political ideas, that we would give them time on stage, that we would allow them to have booths, distribute leaflets, and so on. And it had been our very firm intention to keep this as non-political as possible. This was 3 days of peace and music. Abbie Hoffman summoned us down to his headquarters down in Greenwich Village in New York and announced that if we did not come across with some money and some stage time and booths and so on, that he was going to make our life a misery. Nothing he could do could have made our lives more miserable than they were by that July. We'd already been kicked out of our first site, so we said essentially do your worst.
Which was what?
Well, his worst turned out to be he jumped up on stage during The Who's performance and was booted off unceremoniously by Roger Daltrey. Later on, I think he did manage to distribute some leaflets, but that weekend stayed at least for the course of the weekend, resolutely non-political. It was just 500,000 people trying to have a good time.
Well, you had hoped to make a big profit on Woodstock, and you had printed up plenty of tickets, but the festival ended up a free festival, and this is how the announcement of the free festival sounded on stage.
This is one thing that I was going to wait a while before we talked about, but maybe we'll talk about it now so you can think about it, because we all have to make some kind of plans for ourselves. It's a free concert from now on. That doesn't mean that anything goes. What that means is we're going to put the music up here for free. Now, let's face the situation. We've had thousands and thousands of people come here today. Many, many more than we knew or even dreamt or thought would be possible. We're going to need each other to help each other to work this out, because we're taxing the systems that we have set up. We're going to be bringing the food in. But the one major thing you have to remember tonight, when you go back up into the woods to go to sleep, or if you stay here, is that the man next to you is your brother. And you damn well better treat each other that way, because if they don't, then we blow the whole thing. But we've got it right there.
Well, in fact, the story of how this got to be a free concert has a lot more to do with fear than benevolence. Would you tell the story of why you were forced to make Woodstock a free festival?
Okay, it's even somewhat of a misnomer as described here.
Because some people had already paid. Yeah.
Well, for some people it was not a free festival.
Yeah.
Those unfortunate few who actually bought tickets, many of whom never were able to get to the festival because of the traffic. It certainly wasn't a free festival for John and me. It cost us roughly $3 to $4 million. But it was certainly a free festival in the legend of Woodstock, and it was definitely a free festival for the hundreds of thousands that we just heard in the background while John Morris was making his announcement from the stage.
Now, you had hoped to have, what, about 20 turnstiles that ticket holders would walk through?
We had them. We built them. The gates were up. The turnstiles were up. Ticket takers had been identified, and, in fact, their uniforms had been designed. It was really all set. Unfortunately, all of that had been constructed in Wallkill, New York, some weeks prior to the actual event. And with roughly 34 days to go, the Zoning Board of Appeals of Wallkill met one evening in response to local pressure and revoked permits that we had had for months while we finished our construction. So an entire festival construction, at great expense and effort, was out the window. We were booted from that site, and with a little more than 5 weeks to go, we had to reconstruct the entire festival site in White Lake, New York. Now, this meant that some things had to be done triple time. Overtime was very expensive, even in those days. We hired a lot more staff. We had a thousand people working at our peak, trying to recreate the festival. A couple of days before the event was supposed to start, it really came down to, do we finish the stage, or do we try to get the stage even workable, or do we build fences and ticket gates once again? At that point, it kind of was put to John and me. Are we still in this for the money? Do we take a chance with the crowd? Do we take a chance with what may be the peaceful outcome of the festival, which we had worked so hard to maintain throughout the promotion period? We thought about it for a millisecond, I think, and said, build the stage, make sure the crowd is taken care of, make sure the systems are in place to support them, and we'll worry about taking tickets later.
Now, you had planned to have a lot of off-duty New York City police to come and keep the peace at the festival. At the last minute, the police reneged on the offer because the person who had made the offer got a heart attack and his replacement didn't think it was a very wise idea. But while you were still planning on using the New York City off-duty police,
yes,
what kind of deal did you have with them? Were they going to bus people for doing illegal things like smoking marijuana and dropping LSD or walking around naked?
No, they weren't. We had rather extensive interviews and rehearsals with the off-duty policemen that we selected. In fact, we had applicants, I think over 1,000 applicants for about 300 places, and we would pose questions to them such as, if a young man with long hair comes up to you over the course of the weekend and blows marijuana smoke in your face, what is the correct reaction? If the policeman said, I'd take my nightstick and whop him one, then we would look for another candidate. If he said, I'd smile and walk away, then we probably had the right guy. What we wanted there was not a group of people to bust the crowd. We wanted people who were tolerant, who would keep the peace, who would see that people did not hurt each other, and who basically had bought into the dream and the idea of 3 days of peace and music.
What did you do for replacements?
Well, believe it or not, most of them showed up anyway. And it was really quite amusing because they didn't use their real names. They would sign in as Mickey Mouse or Pluto or Batman or something like that. And matching up Batman with the money he was owed was, as I recall, one of the more interesting tasks after the festival. So I would say of the 300 we hired, over 250 actually showed up, and they did a fine job.
The first night of the Woodstock Festival, that Friday night, there was a terrible thunderstorm. On stage, it sounded something like this.
It looks like we're going to get a little bit of rain, so you better cover up. Hurry up. If it does, and if we should have a slight power problem, just cool it out. We'll sit here with you. We'll be okay.
Everybody get out!
And let's keep it nice and cool. All right, everybody just sit down. Wrap yourself up.
While that was happening, behind the scenes, you were all worrying about mass electrocution. What had happened electrically that was the worry?
It was a nightmare. We had been... it really was... It probably was the bleakest moment of the festival for me. We were sprouting walkie-talkies from every ear at that point and dealing with a dozen problems every minute or two. And on top of it all, the phone rang. The chief electrician was calling from backstage. I asked him what the problem was. He sounded pretty shaky, actually, at the time, even for a man who was going through what he was going through. He said, with the rain and all of those hundreds of thousands of feet scuffling over the performance area, the main feeder cables supplying electricity to the stage, the musicians, the amplifiers, whatever, have been unearthed. And with additional abrasion from these sneakers and whatever and sandals, it may wear away the insulation on these cables. I'm worried with all those wet bodies packed together that we may have something approximating a... And he paused for a moment, and I couldn't believe that he was searching for the words that he came up with, but he came up with mass electrocution. I thought to myself, this is incredible. This can't be happening. He said, what do you want me to do? Should I shut down the power to the stage? Now, we had a philosophy there at headquarters that one of the reasons that this festival was proceeding so well, in spite of the adversities that everybody there was facing, the weather, the tremendous crowds, the strain on all facilities, was that the music was so mesmerizing. It was wonderful talent, brilliant artists performing. The kids were just in love with it. The thought of shutting the power down in the darkness, in the rainstorm, struck me as an invitation to chaos. Nevertheless, the thought of a mass execution posed additional moral problems. At that point, I remember breaking a two-year moratorium on smoking. I think I lit up three or four Camels at once and stuck them in my mouth and tried to think this one through. Finally, the electrician helped me out. He said, look, I think there's a chance that in the next 20 minutes I can work a shunt from the power source to the stage that bypasses those main feeder cables, and maybe that'll solve the whole problem. I said, give it a try, and hung up. And for the next 20 minutes, John and I sat there looking at each other. I guess we were waiting, like in the movies, for the lights to dim a little bit, the way they do when they throw the switch in the electric chair chamber. And I think it probably took 100 years for those 20 minutes to pass. The phone rang, and it was the chief electrician again. He said, I did it. Everything's fine.
Joel Rosenman and John Roberts, two of the original producers of Woodstock, speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. John Roberts died in 2001. Joel Rosenman lives in New York and runs a venture capital firm. One of the most widely acclaimed shows on television, AMC's Mad Men, returns on Sunday for its third season. Our TV critic David Biancooley has this preview.
There was plenty of suspense in the cliffhanger that ended AMC's Mad Men at the end of season two. Sterling Cooper had been bought by a British firm, and John Hamm's Don Draper had walked away, unhappy with the company's newly appointed president, and unsure if he would return after the weekend. When Don got home, his wife dropped the bomb that she was pregnant. And speaking of bombs, all of this took place during the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, when the world was on the brink of nuclear annihilation. But if that's not enough suspense for you, series creator Matthew Weiner always manages to generate more. He doesn't begin a new season precisely where the old one left off. So as a new year of Mad Men begins, there's always the question, is it a new year? If we left off in 1962 during the missile crisis, where will we pick up? He wouldn't leapfrog over the 1963 John F. Kennedy assassination, would he? The answer comes very early in Sunday's premiere episode, so it's not exactly a state secret. Mad Men never says what year it is or what month in the first episode. But since Don's wife is still pregnant, we know it's less than 9 months later. So, by inference, we're still in that small 60s window known as the Age of Camelot. After James Bond, before the JFK assassination. And predictably, the new British owners have their own agendas. One is to call a meeting to fire Bert, the head of accounts. Another is to dispatch Don, played by John Hamm, to Baltimore, to charm an old client who has a British connection of his own.
I apologize for Baltimore. It has to be done.
Well, it's a sales call. Isn't there more I can do here?
It's not a sales call. You're the face of our business. They need someone they can trust. London fog. How ludicrous.
Really? I have one.
So do I. No, of course. It's just the name. There is no fog in London. There is no London fog. Are you sure about that? Quite. Never was. It was the coal dust from the industrial era. Charles Dickens and whatnot.
Mr. Cooper, Mr. Pearson is here to see you.
Come on in, Bert.
Hey, Don.
Bert? Lane?
We need you to have a seat, Bert.
Okay.
A lot of this episode has to do with the seismic shift of a corporate takeover. Of course, this mirrors perfectly how unsettled we're all feeling in this new millennium. And by now, we know all the employees at Sterling Cooper well enough to be fascinated by how they react. Roger, Pete, Peggy, they all angle for ways to protect or expand their turf. And even Joan, the va-va-voom secretary played by Christina Hendricks, holds her own in this pre-Beatles British invasion. While Bert, who's just been fired, throws a temper tantrum behind closed doors, Joan stands outside and gets into a verbal duel with the British boss's new secretary, a man, whom the other secretaries, citing a James Bond character, disparagingly refer to as Moneypenny.
I assume you can continue to handle this beautifully while I dispense psychotherapy to the girls in the pool.
You Americans don't know how to handle your emotions. It's unbecoming.
His wife is sick. And if you had talked to his girl, she would have informed him.
So he would have had a longer walk to Mr. Cooper's.
And if you had talked to me, I would have been waiting with his coat and his Rolodex.
While we're on the topic of decorum, I'd like to speak with you about the way I'm being addressed.
Could you be more specific?
The switchboard. I'm not John. I'm Mr. Hooker.
That's the way they've been taught to address the secretaries.
Yes, well, as I've explained, in Great Britain...
A truck is a lorry and an elevator is a lift. I've got it, Mr. Hooker. Despite your title, you are not a secretary.
I'm Mr. Price's right arm. I'm not his typist.
Of course. Good
luck, everybody. I love how politely defiant Joan is in that scene. And let's admit it, how attractive. Lots of people, starting with Hamm's Don Draper, are ridiculously handsome or beautiful in this 1960s drama. But Christina Hendricks and her well-rounded curves may make Joan the most retrosexual Mad Men character of all, as well as one of the most complex. The characters, even more than the setting, are what make this show so captivating. No matter which character is on screen, you could follow that character for the rest of the hour without complaint. Not many drama series are written that well and cast that deeply, to make you emotionally invested in almost everyone. The Wire, Homicide, Life on the Street, The Sopranos, The Shield, Damages. It's not a very long list, but it is an impressive one. And Mad Men belongs right up there with them. It's one of the finest TV dramas ever made. And the new season begins just as strongly as last season ended.
David Bianculli writes for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches television and film at Rowan University. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Terry Gross is back on Monday. I'm Dave Davies.